You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Yeah, welcome, welcome. And it's like I told you earlier, you know, we were waiting with bated anticipation for some of the decisions that were made at the 178th meeting of the council. And you say, wow, that's a long time, 178. Well, it's 40 plus years, but there's usually three a year. So that's why this is one of three for the year 2019. Actually, I think it's a second. Anyway, it has not to do with the length of the organization. It's more per year meetings. You know what I'm getting at. I'm confused. Anyway, to unconfuse it is Marlo Sabater. He is a council scientist. And one of the things that when we talked about last time, Marlo, was that, you know, up and coming, here comes 178th meeting, and there were going to be some pretty big decisions being made. I want to review as many of them as we can, but mainly I want to talk a little bit about what you and I talked last time you were in the studio.
That's correct.
And that was our friends, the Kona crabs.
Right.
And incidentally, we had Mark Fitchett, scientist Mark Fitchett in, and I didn't realize that he was also part of that. The assessment process.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to learn a little bit about that, what that was again, but what was the outcome in the meeting? Because everybody was anticipating some decisions were going to be made that might make it more feasible for people to get into Kona crabbing commercially.
That's correct. So at the 178th meeting, the council took action on raising the catch limit for the Hawaii Kona crab.
Mm-hmm.
Because as you remember, we the Science Center developed this new benchmark stock assessment that passed review, and the results of that assessment is very optimistic. It's the stock is not overfished, not experiencing overfishing, and it can allow for an increase in the annual catch limit.
Which actually comes to some people as a surprise, because everybody wants to think that these people, all they want to do is limit us. In actual fact, we might be creating a reason to get more serious about it.
That's correct. I mean, the catch limit is supposed to manage the fishery and limit the fishery in a way that you prevent overfishing from happening. But in this particular case, the new science that was generated was very optimistic. With the new research that has been conducted, we had some series of shows with regards to the how productive the stock is for Kona crab, as well as they're more resilient to limb breakage, and the limbs regenerate.
This was a big scientific deal, and it had been thought before when you're putting the females back, or when you're putting them back, if they break a leg, they're going to die.
Right.
But what they do is they make a new leg.
Right. And that's new research shown here in Hawaii that the individual crabs that we have here are very resilient. They don't bleed out as compared to the ones in other areas.
Yeah. Now, by the way, we call them Kona crabs. Are they specifically unique indigenously to us, or are they found in other places?
No, they're pan-Pacific. They're found in other places. They're called spanner crab in Australia. Mm-hmm. They're also found in the Indo-Pacific. So they're widespread. What's interesting here in our islands is that we have a localized population that, because we're like a tiny dot in the middle of nowhere, right?
Really.
So it's good to know what the stock status is for our area, for our region, and it's good to know that the science supports redevelopment of the fishery.
What if anything came up talking about the Kona crabs, why there is a disparaging difference or perceived difference in the number of females and males and the size of these things? Apparently we've actually impacted that. How do we impact that?
Well, this state statute that prevents the take of females is actually creating an impact on the stock. Luckily, it's not that since the fishery is so small at the moment, that kind of impact is less pronounced. However, physiologically, when you have a regulation that says you can only take female and you have you can only take males and you have to return the females,
mm-hmm.
if the fishery is focused only on one sex, like the males,
yeah,
it will create some sort of a physiological effect.
Sooner or later, that actually will happen.
Right.
I mean, it obviously couldn't happen overnight.
Right.
But over a long period of time, mm-hmm. if you're throwing all the males in the bucket and you're throwing all the females back in the ocean,
right.
it seems like there's a shortage of males. But yep. more importantly, physically, there's a difference in size as well, right?
Right. You know, if you have a fishery that's only focused on the males, for example, the old ones are gone. The old ones, the big ones are going to be taken away. The tiny males are going to be left, and the mating success for a small male with a large female is not going to be that successful. Therefore, in the long run, it'll create impacts.
Yeah. In other words, it makes mating difficult because the male crab, which normally would go on top of the female crab, can't reach.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. You know, that being said, and that's why it was so interesting at the forum to talk about that. But I guess it's determined that at the present point in time, it's going to continue with that.
Right. So right now, based on research, you have like at any given time that you go out corner crabbing, you have 50-50 chance of catching males and females together.
Right.
So and then if you throw away 50% of your catch, which are females, and only retain the 50% male, then that doesn't make it economically viable.
Is it easy to tell the difference?
It's easy to tell the difference. You can look at the the plate underneath the on the tail part. Mm-hmm. No, when it's wide, it's female. If it's narrow, it's
okay.
Male.
There you go.
Yeah. So the council voted to increase the catch limit for Kona crabs, and it's estimated to be at they set the annual catch target at 20% risk of overfishing, with a catch limit of 25,491 pounds compared to currently what we have now is only 3,500 pounds.
Right, so that's significant.
Right.
Incidentally, it's a little harder to gear up and to catch these things, right? I mean, the commercial guys, they're not big operations.
Nope. Yeah. And normally they're also conducted along with other fishing operations like bottom fishing or trolling.
Right.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, though, it would seem that one of the things that would be key to that, and I know it came up a little bit, about is not just increasing the catch limit, but also maybe creating a market. In other words, you got to be able to fishermen has sort of got to guarantee somebody that they're going to go out and catch these things.
Right. It doesn't necessarily mean that if you increase the quota that people would start rushing in and engage in the fishery.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a very this is a generational fishery. The knowledge about the fishery needs to be passed on from generations to generations, and most of the guys, the highliner guys, have dropped off the fishery already because, again, commercial fishing for this, if you're throwing away 50% of your catch, it doesn't make any sense.
Would there be a reason, and how would one reconsider whether or not you should be doing that?
Well, you have to look at the market demand. And right now, there's very few areas. I think only Tamashiros are able to sell them. So it would require some like publicity. Instead of having like Maine lobsters Chinatown tanks, so you can have like Kona crabs in there.
You know, interestingly enough, gang, if you take a look at some of the television shows like The Deadliest Catch and everything, it's not male to female, it's size.
Right.
You know, and they say, okay, if it's not big enough, you got to throw it back. Mm-hmm. One question that always comes up, and somebody said, when you guys talk about Kona crab necks, ask if they are susceptible to mortality because of depth and decompression. Are they?
No, they're not. I mean, we conducted some research that showed they make it to the bottom when you dump, you know, the bucket and with the female corner crabs in it.
Mm-hmm.
We followed them with a 360 degree GoPro
with
camera.
With the GoPro,
and also a drop camera, and they make it down. There's it also depends on which area you're at, right?
Mm-hmm.
If it's an area that has a lot of predators in them, then probably they'd be fed upon. Mm-hmm. But we tried that a couple of times, and you know, known areas with sharks and you know, Kahala and all that, they made it down safe.
Yeah, the thing that you'd want to think of, gang, is if you take a look, let's say that you are typically a small Kona crab guy. Most of these are flat nets, and they got, you know, like, you know, fish heads or something on them, right, for bait. Mm-hmm. And then they're attached. You might have 25 or 50 of them in a string.
Yep.
And going down, they go down pretty quickly because they're weighted, right? Mm-hmm. They go down to the bottom. Mm-hmm. And when you bring them up, if you're gonna throw the female back, does she go down weighted or does she go down just float down?
They just float down. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So and also when we attach some video cameras on the nets,
yeah,
there are some crabs that fall off while being hauled up.
Yeah, of course.
So it's not a very efficient gear to begin mm-hmm. with, mm-hmm. unlike in the industrial commercial fishery in Australia where they're using traps instead of loop nets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, by the way, it's much like the deadliest catch. When you can lay a whole string of them, they call them pots, right? Mm-hmm. You put all these pots out, and you go back to pick them up, and nobody's home.
Yep.
Big, big effort for very, very little return. Mm-hmm. But then sometimes there will be 100 or more in per pot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when, I guess, the cash register really rings. But these guys, and they're separating them so quickly, their eyes are so well-trained, they can tell within, you know, a centimeter if it's a keeper or not.
Right. And there's also a minimum size regulation mm-hmm. from the state, I believe.
Yeah.
So on top of the 50% female estimate.
Now you're looking at size as well.
Also have to dump the small-sized ones, even if it's male or female.
Yeah, one guy told me that when you go to a specific place, that sometimes you're dropping your nets on a place that you've already dropped them, and the fish or the crabs that you get back are the ones that you put back. They're all females or they're all small.
Right.
So where's the cash crop? Okay. Did you get the impression, and we have a lot of other things we want to try to talk about, but did you get the impression that that is significant enough headway so it can get revisited to see if these decisions were good ones?
Yeah, we're the council and the state would be monitoring this fishery jointly and mm-hmm. see whether the increase in the quota would entice people to mm-hmm. re-engage the fishery. It would take some investment to get back
sure.
here, and but at least it would allow the fishery to have a bigger buffer in terms of, mm-hmm. of the quota, and really there were also some recommendations for the state to work towards removing the no take of female.
Yeah, I was going to say no take of female number one,
yeah.
And also the catch limit.
Right. Yeah. So the catch also implement the catch limit uh-huh. within the state waters mm-hmm. because we need to have complementary rules.
Yeah.
So if the catch target has been reached in federal waters, the council and the NMFS would be shutting down mm-hmm. the federal waters. But does that mean that the fisher can still happen within the state waters?
It actually raises as many questions as it did provide answers. And finally, let's make sure that we understand that the methodology and the assessment that Mark Fitchett and others were involved in, a little more sophisticated than in the past. The likely to be the reason why the limits have been raised is because it looks like there's plenty of crab down there.
Right. And the new assessment provided better numbers. It utilized better data.
Mm-hmm.
And then it also, reduced the uncertainty in terms of the science. So we can allow for a higher catch limit.
Okay, that was, for me, one of the things in the meeting that was of special interest, only because I love to see opportunity be created. And I would love to see more Kona crab available. Because first of all, it's delicious, and it's highly sought after. And right now, if you're out there and you're a Kona crab fisherman already, you don't like this story because you want to keep it to yourself. But I think it's going to bear out, right? That there's plenty. We're okay.
Yeah, we're okay. Based on the assessment, we're okay. We're going to run another assessment in 6 years.
Right.
So this catch limit of 25,491 pounds. Is good for starting from year 2020
mm-hmm.
to 2023, and then we'll monitor the fishery. Then if the fishery redevelops, and then we'll revisit this catch limit
again. Yeah, I'm glad about that, and I'm also hoping that we're going to be able to see some of those things. All right, now, there are many, many other things. What are some of the other things more meaningful to you as the scientist, and particularly the environmental side of things?
Well, on the environmental side of things, the council also made some recommendations with regards to refining the precious coral essential fish habitat, mm-hmm. and there are new science out there that based on some of the deep dive research that was conducted within the Hawaiian waters, they discovered some new beds as well as areas that are haven't been explored yet. Mm-hmm. So the council voted on amending its fishery ecosystem plans for Hawaii to refine the precious coral. Although we know that precious coral fishery in Hawaii is currently inactive.
Yeah, and by the way, a lot of people get misunderstand. And one of the things that I think we should bring up from time to time, which I think is really important, is that, you know, while the precious coral is got an industry of its own, you have to be very careful because while, yes, it is providing jobs and pretty big money, some of this stuff, mm-hmm. it also is you're eliminating, you know, a part of the environment that the other animals need. Right. So it's like usually the money wins out, right? And we haven't had too many changes in the coral, but now are there some?
Yes.
Especially geographic areas?
Yeah. So in terms of geographic areas, based on some of the research dives that was conducted. And these are not diving using tanks, but it's deep diving using nitrox and the breather and also using submersibles.
Yeah.
And they found some new beds that needs to be identified mm-hmm. as well as mapped out.
Yeah, and by the way, when you talk about that, you're talking about different species. You're talking about coastal gold coral, the black coral. There's several different, the pink, the rose. There's a lot of different precious mm-hmm. corals.
Right. Yeah. And these are not the regular coral reef, shallow water coral reef corals that we're talking about here. We're talking about like really deep, dark water kind of corals. And these new areas have been mapped out, and that's why we're amending the plans to consider them as essential fish habitats. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the precious coral plans that we have is the very first plan mm-hmm. that was ever developed by the council in the 80s. It was followed by bottom fish, and then the pelagics, mm-hmm. and then crustaceans and coral reefs.
A lot of people didn't draw the line of parallel between precious coral and fish.
And it's a management unit species mm-hmm. for the council to manage, mm-hmm. and so we developed a plan for them, and there was a flourishing fishery for precious corals in the 80s using submersibles. And this is mm-hmm. not like the fisheries in Asia where you use a dragnet that scours the
just
bottom.
Just breaks everything and leaves
a barren landscape. Mm-hmm. The fishery here in Hawaii.
Very selective.
Very selective.
Yeah. It's a good point.
It's hand harvest mm-hmm. for, you know, black corals in the Awau Channel. And then you have also the submersibles with, those pinchers.
Yeah.
And you'd be
amazed how accurate these things are. They'll have a basket. They get that gold coral. They snip it. They cut it. It gets put in the basket, and they fill up the basket and then go home. Bring the submersible back up to the surface.
Right.
Yeah, but still yet. The part of the coral that gets used, I mean, isn't it by its nature trapping certain small things that go through the current and attach them to themselves to the coral? That's the living part of the coral, right?
Right. There's the living part where you have, that they feed upon those mm-hmm. things that they filter out of the water. And also the dead part, which is the skeleton, which is the ones that the fishery is targeting.
Yeah. And that's, of course, that's the value is in that skeleton.
That's correct. So so the council took action, and it's gonna redefine those boundaries and the maps for.
Generally speaking, Marlo. Just so that, and by the way, Marlo Sabater is the scientist with the council, And, you know, and he gets very involved in the environmental side of things too. But I think that this is sort of neat. And that is, you have to be able to see who's utilizing the coral as a food source. Mm-hmm. Because it's not big fish. It's little tiny things.
Right.
They become part of the food chain. But doesn't the coral get eaten by the small fish that swim in, you know, that can handle the current and stay there eating? Because sometimes the current's quite strong there, right?
Whether, right. They prefer areas that has strong current because that's how they feed.
The filtration.
Yeah, they do the filtration. But they provide habitat for small fish and other organisms, invertebrate organisms in the mm-hmm. In the deep bottom benthic surface. Mm-hmm. So they provide refuge for, you can imagine like the bottom substrate is going to be like just flat.
Mm-hmm.
And these corals provide that topographic complexity in the bottom, therefore increasing the diversity of the communities in the deep water areas.
Yeah, I'm very impressed with the methods and everything else. And, you know, as the technology for harvesting has become more sophisticated, so is the technology for observing, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they're using high-resolution sonars nowadays and imaging softwares and things like that, drop cameras. And automated underwater vehicles, so there's technology all over the place being used for mapping and for science.
And gang, that should just give you another example. You got to go to wpcouncil.org and look at some of these other reports that are out there on precious corals, on a lot of things. Great for students, great for you teachers and people that are counselors that show people where there might be a life for them in the fishery. Because I think that, Marla, a lot of people would be surprised today to hear us even talking about coral. You know, we don't need it.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. And it's a fishery for for jewelries and things like that. It's not only for eating, but it's also commodity for certain part of the society.
Do you remember when puka shells were the big deal everywhere throughout the Pacific, all over the place? And they still are in some respects. But people were saying then, you can't keep doing this. You take all of these things out of the ocean, everything has a reason to have something to be there. But those were all end products, right? That was just silt. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think anybody misses the taking of the puka shells, but certainly people would be missing the taking of precious corals.
Right. And also, you got to look at, you're not just look at that organism as a commodity for jewelries and things like that. You also need to look at, if you want to take an ecosystem approach, you need to look at the function of that commodity in its natural environment and assess its value.
Yeah, like what's in those piles of rubble,
right?
There's stuff.
Right. Yeah.
So in any case, I think it's really sort of diverse. It was sort of an interesting thing. What are some of the other highlights of the 178 that some of our people that are weekend warrior fishermen or just people that like to listen to the program and eat fish?
There were a couple of other fishery-related action that the council took. One is, let me see here.
I was thinking about what some of the tuna, some of the tuna quotas were looked at, and some of the other things were looked at. About are we able to open and reopen and keep open part of the fishery for longer because of the stock being in way better condition than some gave a thought.
Yeah. So the council also took action in for the territory Big Eye tuna allocation limits.
Mm-hmm.
So that the U.S. has its tuna quota from the WCPFC, the Western Central Pacific RFMO, and the participating small island developing states and territories also have they don't actually have a quota.
Mm-hmm.
Since they're small island developing state, they have an unlimited quota.
But right.
The NMFS and the council set an allocation for them just to be on the conservative side.
Yeah. Now, from what I understand, a part of that is to prevent people from going into a place that doesn't have a quota and just taking what they want.
Right.
And so, once again, that boils down to, however, enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
Was there discussions about increased enforcement in certain parts of the district because of that?
This allocation this allocation system that was or process that was developed is self-enforcing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the council voted on having an allocation of 1,500 metric tons of bigay for Sinimae, Guam, and American Samoa.
Yeah. Now, by the way, when we had Nate Ilawa last week talking about that, is that the locals that understand what these limits are, they know exactly what to do, and they're the first ones to call for help when they see a foreign vessel that's fishing within a restricted area. And so it's not like people having to fist fight with each other. There's authorities, and many times it's the Coast Guard.
Right. Yeah. So the Coast Guard is the agency responsible for enforcing the federal regulations. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's exciting because they know what they're doing. And look, sometimes these foreign vessels, they just need to be reminded that they're a little too close. You know, but they keep pushing the limit, right? They're going to keep trying.
Right. And
the
also,
fish don't know where they are, by the way.
Yeah. So, but the vessels know where the fish are. So there was an interesting presentation at the council meeting from Global Fishing Watch,
mm-hmm.
which is this organization that
give us a report. What did they come up with?
So they presented the different technologies that they have in their arsenal to detect vessels at any given place at any given time.
Yep.
So they can also identify which flag vessels there are. So you can see we had some posters at the meeting,
mm-hmm.
where you can see that the Hawaii exclusive economic zone,
yeah.
just right outside the boundaries of Hawaii, EEZ, you have the Chinese fleet just mm-hmm. lingering around.
And there's so many, you can't believe
them. There are so many of them. Yeah. And within just a 6-month period,
mm-hmm.
that you look at the data, it's like our EEZ is dotted with Chinese vessels, hanging out, mm-hmm. just right around the border.
And you can't help but think, let's say that they respect your sovereignty and your border, but that means that nothing's going to get into there. I mean, if they ring around the rosy, they'll catch the fish.
Mm-hmm. And it's hard to enforce these kinds of things because the Coast Guard has limited resources. But like we said all along, the council's position is that the fishing vessels, the U.S. fishing vessels, are the eyes and ears of the Coast Guard out there. If they detect some of these vessels that's not U.S. flagged inside the EEZ, and they can report it to the Coast Guard, and the Coast Guard can take action.
Well, I think that's I think that's one of the good takeaways that people ought to understand. You know, the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council is the largest of all the councils in the country. It's responsible for more real estate, and they have so much to do and such limited resources in some respects. That you can get the job done is a miracle in itself sometimes, isn't it?
Right, yeah. Right. You got to do what you have to do with the limited resources that you have. You just have to maximize what's available.
Yeah, gee whiz. But yet, all of you that I talk to, especially you and sometimes Josh DeMello and Mark Fitchett and Asuka, everybody, are still optimistic that, okay, we may be taxed and we may be spread pretty thin, but we can do this. We can get this job done.
Right, with the cooperation between the industry, the fishermen, the federal agencies, and the council, it's totally doable. We just have to prioritize which issues we need to deal with, and allocate resources to answer those kinds of questions.
Wow. Okay. So anyway, before the time runs out, I want to make sure that there are a few other things. Some of the things that were important to you. Some of the things that you like.
The council would also be coming up with a workshop on blue ocean spatial management.
Yeah.
And this will happen next year.
Yeah, that's great.
There's a huge movement right now for closing the international waters, the pelagic waters from fishing.
Mm-hmm.
And from the council's perspective is that before you take such kinds of action and start removing people from their fishing grounds,
there has to be
some science, there has to be some monitoring, there has to be some standards or best practices that needs to be implemented first before you take those kinds of action, because without science, without monitoring, you don't know how effective those things are, and you're just creating some disproportionate burden on the different parties that's utilizing the resource.
You know, I knew you were going to say that, and I'm glad you did in this respect, and I think this is very important. What we're talking about here is that everybody's desire is to do the right thing. We have a longline fleet here, the Hawaii longline fleet, that is, every trip is monitored, every trip.
Right.
And so, especially in the shallow set was what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And what you said, I want to circle back to this. It is hard for a fisherman or a lover of eating fish to understand that you're going to shut down a fishery based on an interaction with a certain species that is not dying. They're just in the vicinity. That means if all of a sudden you get a big school of loggerheads in a certain area, that means you're done.
Yeah, and
I don't get that.
And understanding the dynamics, and it shouldn't be, management system should be flexible, right? Mm-hmm. It should be adaptive. It should be dynamic. It's not supposed to be a static thing that, you know, once this happened, you have to apply this kinds of this management measure. You have to understand first why the interaction has been increased.
Yeah,
it can be due to like a certain oceanographic feature that attracts the turtle and the fish at the same time. So, having to understand that dynamics is very important before you can craft certain reasonable, prudent measures that would limit or restrict the fishery from expanding, taking advantage of a resource that's not in the resource, meaning the swordfish, that's not overfished, experiencing overfishing.
You know, that the interesting thing to me on that was, first of all, what installed that number in the first place? You know, it's always an arbitrary number. 17 loggerhead turtles. I don't get it. You know, one year there could be 50, one year there could be 4.
Yep.
But what happens is, I guess somebody at one point in time said, so goes the loggerhead, so goes the area, or something.
Right. And this is typically a black box
that we're
trying to crack. And, you know, it's interesting that looking at what's happening in terms of the population of the turtle, for example, is totally treated independently of what's the interaction rate in the fishery. So, but those things has to be married together, merged together to come up with a complete story, and not just focus your 17 turtles because of the historical interaction versus knowing that the population of the turtles is increasing, for example.
Yeah, and by the way, gang, there's something else, and I didn't have a chance to talk to Marlo here about it, but I'm sure you saw in the news just the other day that Japan has decided to resume the capture of whales, to eat whales again. And not that they ever stopped, but they've come out in defiance of a lot of things. And I know it was probably kicked around a little bit. I know the story didn't come out until actually the meetings were finished. But did that come up at all during this year?
It didn't come up at the at our council meeting.
It would have if the council meeting was next month.
Probably, but you know, we're operating, the U.S. fisheries is operating under a strict
MFP, no whaling.
Strict rule about whaling. So we're bound by the MMPA with regards
but
to and also ESA.
The reason I said that, Marlo, is because, you know, we all get together and we feel so badly when there's a whale carcass and stuff in our local waters, and even though it provides a food chain, it's like, oh, these poor things. It pales in comparison, all of these animals that we're talking about, to when a couple of 3 or 4 whaling boats go out in the Sea of Japan and kill 50.
Right, you know, right. Yeah. And they managed to do that, to just justify that as you know, whaling as part of their culture. It's the same as in the Scandinavian
absolutely
countries,
it
where
is.
They have
absolutely.
Their traditional food source is marine mammals.
Yeah, well, and it's the very same thing up in Alaska and in Siberia and other places where they have native rights to do takes that are way, way outside of what would normally be thought.
I saw that that news clip. I believe it was in one of our local TV channels released that just the other day in the morning show, and they they really had to insert it in there that, you know, we also want to add that European and the U.S., some of the U.S.
Right, are very strict.
No, they didn't say strict, but they said, that also have that kind of system yeah. where it's traditionally harvested.
Now that it's said and done and you everybody has a chance to roll up their sleeves, I do know that so many of the reports that we talked about on this show during the year were utilized there. All in all, the overall impressions of the 178th meeting, what were some of the, real quickly, some of the accomplishments that you appreciated and overall just your personal critique of how the meeting was. Was it a good one?
Well, it was a pretty good meeting. We discussed a bunch of issues that pertains to our fisheries. We were able to just for a wrap up, we were able to increase the quota for Kona crabs, redefine the precious coral essential fish habitat, and also had final decisions on the allocation limits for our pelagic fisheries.
Yeah, it seems like a lot got accomplished. I mean, yep. I know that the Joe Q public, they enjoy the forum and they enjoy some of the things, but realizing how much energy is going on there. For those that want to keep track, you go to wpcouncil.org and review a lot of what Malloy and I were just talking about. I mean, Marlo and I were just talking about. But let's also talk about the next meeting. When is it and where?
The next meeting is going to be in October. This is our roadshow. We're going to be going to American Samoa.
Yeah, that's great.
To go around to talk about some American Samoa fishery issues.
Well, thanks so much and good job. And can't wait to talk some more next time. Thanks, Marlo.
Thank you.
Okay, and if you want to hear something on the program, you know what to do. TheMikeBuckShow@gmail.com. TheMikeBuckShow@gmail.com. And please go review what happened at the meeting. There's in the next couple of days, a whole bunch of things are going to be trickling out. Make a regular stop, the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council webpage, wpcouncil.org. Have a great time. And hopefully you had enough of a 4th of July weekend to survive for another trip. See you next time. Aloha.